Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Goods here on CKT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. I'm Doug Miller. No, it's not Andy. It's Doug Miller, and that's not Amandla. I'm co-hosting the show with Andy Williams, where I normally co-host the Amandla show. Today's focus of The Goods show, as always, will be the great music that Andy likes to play, but it's also going to be on Andy himself and celebrate his 25 years here at CKUT. And that's all part of the CKUT oral history project known as Time Capsule. It's a record of the kind of alternative everything that CKUT gets involved in: music, news, culture, the city, everything. It does appear as archives that can be downloaded right after the show, and it's going to be also run as podcasts later on. You can get those through iTunes and I think iCloud or some other place. Anyway, we're here to talk to Andy about his work on the show The Goods and his many other shows at CKUT. So, good afternoon, Andy. How
good
are you?
Good afternoon. All right.
Good, good, good. Listen, Andy, I don't even know where to start.
It's easy. I can start. Well, it's, as you said, it's been 25 years, but it's actually been over 30-plus years working at various other radio stations. In Toronto, I worked at Chin Radio, which is a multicultural station. And I also worked at Ryerson, CKLN, and I did a show called The Mixed Bag there.
Let me guess.
Yeah. Well, it was mostly jazz, but there was a lot of other things. R&B, soul, funk, broken beat, two-step, disco, you know, prison songs, a whole bunch of, right through the gamut.
Okay, well, before we go into your radio career too much, I would like to go backwards in your life and find out more about the beginning. I was quite fascinated to find out that you were born in Derby, England, but I don't hear any of that accent in there.
Well, I left at 12 years old, and what usually happens is that if you stay in a foreign country like England or Italy or wherever you're from, you maintain your accent after 12 years old. 14, so most of you in your teens. So I left at 12, and from there I moved to New York. From New York I moved to Jamaica, then Jamaica to Toronto.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Oh, so you've been around then.
Right.
Now, the family, I presume, coming from the Caribbean originally?
That's right, Jamaican Cuban.
And so they're in England and New York and...
Yeah. Well, my dad first went there in 1952.
Oh my goodness.
And he was living in London, and at the time, it was like really hard to get work. So the only time you could get an apartment is if you knew a black nurse, whether it was a West Indian nurse or an African nurse, and the landlords would rent the places to the nurses, but not to the men.
Aha.
Yeah. So my dad said it was really kind of awkward and disgusting in some ways. Four guys sleeping on a bed, rotating so they can go on shift work. And then until you save enough money to move to where you want to move to, whether it's London, at the time it was London, Luton, outside of London, Battersea, Balham, Brixton. Those were the mostly the main places for West Indians. And my dad went to Derbyshire because there was a lot of work in Derbyshire. And as probably a lot of you know, Derbyshire was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. So in Derby, we had the Concorde, we had British Railway, we had Crown Derby, which is China.
Sure.
We had Rolls-Royce, we had British Leyland, we had many other places I can't even recall right now because I'm trying to figure them.
Must have been an exciting time for you.
Yeah, but it's a small little place, so a lot of people lived on the outskirts. So the outskirts of Derby would be a place called Micklover, Littleover, or another town, which is Nottingham, Birmingham. And right throughout the Midlands is where a lot of West Indians and Africans left.
Well, there must have been a nice mix of cultures as well. I'm sure you were.
Sure, sure.
Even by then, you were starting to get exposed to a variety of musical forms.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the stuff I brought with us, one of the first tracks I brought over is Little Anthony. And the kind of things my folks would listen to, which is doo-wop and R&B. You know, extensive collection, like myself. My dad and my mom always had records. But my mom was a workaholic. She wasn't at home as much as my dad. My dad was a county cricket player.
Oh.
Yeah, so he played for Derbyshire. And my mom started off as a nurse at 16 and then worked her way up. So she became just a head a nurse, then a head nurse, then a matron. So she ended up running Pastor's Hospital, which is the name of the hospital in Derby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So we hardly saw her. And then she had a place in Pastor's Hospital where Jeff and I would come and stay sometimes. Or if my dad wasn't home, we sent for my grandmother from the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
and she'd take care of us. So I didn't really grow up with my mom because she was quite a workaholic, as I said.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you weren't just exposed to music then. You were obviously a student, but I understand you enjoyed a lot of sports.
Well, no, music was always around us. England is the infestation of music is ridiculous. When you're having supper, Top of the Pops is on TV, you know, and then there's all these other shows that you can watch. Then on the radio, you have John Peel, if you've heard of John Peel. And, you know, and all sorts of people. And Derby was actually a hotbed for music because of the West Indian community throughout the area, throughout that region.
West Indian, West African, all sorts of
all sorts of stuff, yeah.
And what kind of music did you say was being played around the house?
Jazz, doo-wop, R&B, reggae, lots of reggae, but not the reggae we listen to nowadays, really conscious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the reggae was what we refer to as reggae-ing, which is reggae with strings, which we don't really hear anymore.
Yeah. What's the difference? Give us a... Come on. Explain this.
Reggae, reggae with violin, reggae with cello, reggae with...
Oh, wow. Yeah. Very interesting. So have you got anything from that time that you...
I just gave Alex Little Anthony, and he's not actually playing that right now. I think he's playing the Morris Williams, right? Okay, so it's... Craig Williams, you mean. Is it Craig Douglas or Craig Williams? Okay, Craig Douglas. His famous track, and my mom had that record too, and this is pretty much what my mom would listen to. His famous track was Only 16, which was on par with the Beatles at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a 60s child, right? I was born in 62.
There you go.
So I got to see 9 years or 8 years of music coming through that time period. And then 70s totally changed.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And the 60s were setting the tone for so many things.
And
you being in England, you would have not just the American side, but all that British influence too.
Yeah, and only that, we had all these record shops where you get stuff hot off the press. And, you know, on weekends, my folks would go to the marketplace, and I'd go and ask for a record or two, and my folks can... you know, be nice enough to give me a record or two. And I was too young for the teeny bopper disco clubs, but I still got in because I had some hip friends in my neighborhood who were probably 14 to 15 years old. And I started going when I was about 10 years old.
Oh, boy.
And the scene still goes on because when I was there, it's called Tiffany's. And then Tiffany's became Pink Coconut. And that... the Pink Coconut thing became a franchise throughout the Midlands. So I was really surprised to hear that. There's going to be a person here this afternoon who's actually still performing at those places.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
And those were that live music or was that...
Live music and DJs.
And DJs.
Yeah.
Okay.
So... So a lot of DJs, a lot of music lovers, as I just said, you know, it was so much music. It was infestation, and it's still like that, you know. Whether you're in London, there's a West London scene with a broken beat, there's grunge, grunge is Seattle, but whatever, there's everything. There's two-step, disco, funk.
And it's always a bit cutting edge, London has always been.
Yeah, it's always been that, yeah.
As you say, this piece is by Craig.
No, right now it shifted. Right now it's another track that my mom used to play, and that's Etta James, Tell Mama.
Yeah. Can we get some volume on that?
Yeah, can we get some volume on that?
She had all the men throw you outdoors. Now the same man.
So, you know, rest in peace, Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin was in the house. So was Etta James, Dinah Washington, Nina Simone.
Wow, the whole...
Eartha Kitt.
And these were all so familiar to everybody Baker. In those communities.
Well, a lot of West Indians were listening to that stuff. And believe it or not, a lot of the records I couldn't have because they wouldn't let me touch them was country and western.
Oh, really?
A lot of West Indians were listening to country and western, and a lot of Nigerians were listening to country and western.
Oh, yes. Very popular.
Yeah. And in the Congo also, a lot of people in Congo would listen to country and western, and that's how they formulated Congolese rumba.
I remember getting to Malawi in 68 and hearing the tune Snowflake sung by, oh my goodness, what was his name? Famous country and western singer. And there I am in Malawi, Africa, and they're singing the song Snowflake. Yeah. It's my pretty little snowflake.
Well, guarantee you, Nick can probably attest to this, guarantee you, every West Indian had a Jim Reeves record in
That's
their collection.
Yes.
Jim Reeves was like the number one guy. Charlie Pride, Jim Reeves,
mm-hmm.
and later on in Jamaica became Kenny Rogers and Celine Dion and whatnot. But back in the day, Freddie Fender, all those cats were like, they're hot on the tracks.
I'm pretty sure that's when I got my first exposure to country and western, that's for sure. So there you are, you're in England, you're listening to music a lot. I think you must have played soccer if you were...
Oh yeah, I played soccer. I left just when I was supposed to make the team. I was coached by a famous coach by the name of Brian Clough. He coached Derby for a bit, then he coached Nottingham Forest. He was my under-12 coach. And I made the team when I was 10. But as I said, my mom got a great job in New York and decided to leave.
Uh-huh.
And then the whole family left.
So the family moved with her?
We didn't move with her. I actually my brother and I went to Jamaica to boarding school so we can actually see how my folks were living.
Okay.
So I went to a school called Clarendon College. And my brother went to a school called Thompsontown.
Well, that must have been a really interesting return.
Well, it was very interesting because I learned a lot more about music in terms of how music was sampled. You know, a lot of reggae artists were taking soul tracks and turning them into reggae tracks. You know, like, for example, Is It Because I'm Black, Syl Johnson.
Mm.
Well, Ken Booth did a great job of one of those tracks, right? And there's a lot of Jamaicans really doing that, you know, where they take a soul track and just flip it.
And do it. Wow.
And, yeah.
And you were able to get out of the school and go to visit that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, we're right across the street from an orange field called Danks.
Oh, yeah.
And those are my trouble years, but I don't really mind talking about that. So although I was up in the boarding school area and stuff, we'd actually go to Danks and hang out with the Rastamen because they were mostly the pickers mm-hmm. of the oranges. But they had enough ganja, tons of ganja. So we would go out on breaks and go and puff a little and come back to class really bummed out and weird. And the teachers don't really know what's going on.
There's a private school education for you.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, and you buy something really cheap and save some money for the ganja. You know, you buy some bun and cheese.
Yeah.
And which is like really orange processed cheese. And we ate that, which was really like poor man's food. But it was all about having the ganja.
Did you also get introduced to your family back in
Oh, yes. My Uncle Rupi, who I spent time with, he was running the water supply in Jamaica. Irrigation land, and a lot of my aunts were teachers. Two were principals, and I had a few uncles who were actually working for the government. And at the time when I was there, which was from 74 to 76, it was really politically hot in terms of being with a party. If you were with the wrong party, you could be in trouble,
mm-hmm.
whether you were with the People's National Party or the Jamaica Labor Party.
Mm-hmm.
So my family were with the People's National Party, which is Michael Manley,
mm-hmm.
and the other party was with Edward Siaga, mm-hmm. the Jamaican Labor Party.
And how did you read things when you were there? Was it
Well, I was too young to actually jump into that, but I just followed what my family was following. And, you know, I made sure that, you know, I'd be wearing a guarabira, or we call it bush jacket, and khaki pants, and made sure everything was clean, because they were a pretty strict family
where
I came from. So, you know, my clothes were tailor-made.
Wow.
And that continued on until I was in Toronto, until about grade 11.
Okay.
I just started wearing penis pants and Kodiaks once I got to grade 11. But prior to that, it was like, you know, tailor-made pants, whether it's serge material. It had to be serge material or gabardine. Anything else wasn't really...
Wasn't acceptable for school wear.
No, we called it judging clothes. Mm-hmm. It's clothes that you couldn't be seen in. So if I went outside with my judging clothes, my dad would say, take that off.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I had to put my serge pants on or my gabardine pants on.
You had to be presentable.
I had to be presentable.
Oh, man. Yeah. So in Jamaica, though, back to music, what kind of things did you run into?
Well, my Uncle Clive would take me out in nighttime to see all these top DJs, whether it's Big Youth and all these cats. And in Blackwoods, there was these open areas where these DJs could set up. There's a person that Bob Marley talks about, and he made a song, and he made a reference to Mr. Brown. Well, Mr. Brown was running the show in Clarendon, and he was well-known throughout the island. So I would see all these guys coming on their scooters selling records on the in a little box mm-hmm. in the back of the records, and they're just out of the press.
Oh, boy.
So I got to experience all that.
And you made a collection, I hope, at that time.
Not at that time. My collection became... when I was probably around 15 years old.
By now you're in Toronto.
My uncle Earl from Baltimore, I was in Toronto then, yeah. My uncle Earl from Baltimore had a club, and he had jukeboxes on each floor.
Oh, boy.
So when he came to visit my dad, he'd give me the 45s.
From the jukeboxes.
So that was it was like Christmas for me all the time.
Wow.
So I was hearing, you know, The Way You Make Me Feel by, you know, The Whispers or, you know, early Confunction tracks.
All the latest hits,
all the latest hits, whether it's Millie Jackson or whether, you know, a whole bunch of stuff.
Amazing. Yeah. So you're the best thing going there with an uncle. Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to tell you that it's always been in me. It's part of my blood. I've always had music around me, whether it's my Uncle Bobsy was a DJ in Derby, and he was known as Ute. It is youth, mm-hmm. but in Patois, it's youth, mm-hmm. right? So I got records off him too later on. When I went back to play basketball, I went and played professional basketball in England, back in my hometown,
okay.
because I wasn't considered an import because I was from Derby.
Okay.
So I'd spend time with my auntie in it and my Uncle Bobsy, and he'd give me a crazy amount of records to bring back to Toronto.
But you're hooked on music. Did you ever play any music? Did you ever play an instrument?
Yeah, I started off playing piano, but I didn't like my Russian teacher. She'd hit me with a ruler on my knuckles.
Oh, that's really inspirational, isn't it?
Yeah, she'd hit me on my knuckles because I wasn't building a house. And then later on, I found out that, you know, Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell and all these guys were playing flat-handed.
Mm.
So why do I have to play with building a house? So that was a little frustrating, and I have some regrets, but at the same time, I still immersed myself into music, yeah. So it didn't really matter.
So the playing died eventually?
The playing died eventually, yeah.
Okay, so now we got you in Toronto. You're an athlete, so you're playing soccer and basketball, and you're still collecting music like mad, going to school. What did you study in the end in Toronto?
In Toronto? I went to high school there. I went to Parkdale Collegiate and Humberside Collegiate, and I was a strong math student. Everything else didn't really care. My dad was a draftsman, so he's always doing draft work or doing puzzles and crosswords. So I spent a lot of time with him at the table doing math and things like that, and I really became strong because of this one teacher, mm-hmm. Ms. Vakil.
Mm-hmm.
She always had me do the samples on the board, and there's this other guy named Adam Dirkwitz. So if it wasn't me, it was Adam Dirkwitz. Like, does anyone know this question, the answer? If it's, yeah, so
one of you would have it.
One of us would have it.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
And so you finished high school there?
Yeah.
And then?
I did all my post-secondary education in Quebec.
Oh, you came here.
I went to Bishop's University. I was supposed to go to York University, but I fell in love with the campus because I came for a Bishop's basketball camp.
Ah.
So I called my dad up. I said, look, I think I'm not going to go to York. He's actually listening right now as we speak.
Ah.
I said, Dad, I'm not going to go to York. I'm going to go to Bishop's. And he goes, why do you want to go there? So I told him, you know, it's got a golf course, it's Eastern Townships. So I gave him a quick little history of the place. And he said, okay, if that's what you want, let's do it. So So
wonderful.
So I ended up playing basketball there and doing the sciences at Bishop's.
Oh, you did your first degree there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. At Bishop's. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a wonderfully small town campus.
Yeah, there was 1,300 kids when I was there, mm-hmm. or 1,200 kids.
I don't think it's changed all that much.
Yeah,
The big advantage the students say is that their teachers get to know you very well. The big disadvantage is the teachers get to know you very well.
Yeah, in the science department, there was probably about eight of us.
Oh yeah, that was small.
Yeah, really small. So I really enjoyed that.
My daughter did biology there.
Yeah.
That's a very, very cool.
And then after that, I went to play basketball in 1984 in Derby.
So that's when you went back.
When I went back in 1984.
How long were you there?
I got cut after 6 weeks.
Oh.
But coincidentally, our center on the basketball team from Bishop's was trying out for the team there, trying out for Derby, John L. Turbos, but I didn't even know he was coming. So here we are, thousands and thousands of miles away, and 6'10", Nick Van Herk is in the gym, and we're both from Bishop's University, and we're just like, wow.
That's a coincidence.
It was quite a coincidence. And he made the team, and I played for a while. I it was really hard trying to beat out a 6'7" shooting guard or a 6'5" point guard.
At the professional level,
and, my defense was good enough, but I didn't really have the killer.
Mm-hmm.
In basketball or any sports, you have to have the killer. My thing was mostly about team concept.
So then
working with
back
people.
To where now? From Derby or basketball?
So I stayed for a bit, and I stayed for under a year, and then I came back. And
at that point, you had no family. Old uncle.
Oh yeah, I had an uncle on my dad's side, and I had an aunt on my mom's side in Derby.
Okay.
Yeah, so I stayed with both of them for a bit and made the best of it, and then went back to Toronto. And then I applied to school because I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I did some research on things that I liked. So I figured I'd try sports medicine.
Oh.
So I went to Toronto Institute of Medical Technology, and I did chiropody, which is the Canadian version of podiatry.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So my favorite part of that was, once again, the math part, biomechanics.
Mm.
So I spent a lot of time checking out athletes and how they move, putting them on treadmills, building orthotics, a whole bunch of crazy things. And I did that for probably around 5 years, I think. Yeah. And then I didn't think it was enough, so I wanted to actually be the team guy, not the team physician, but like the sports therapist. So I did some massage work, and I went to Sutherland Chan School, which is like the oldest massage school in Canada.
Oh, cool.
And
nice.
And I did work there. And then from there, I got work with a famous racquetball player, Youngest Khan.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so I worked with Youngest Khan for a while. And then I had my own office in the Royal York Hotel on the top floor. And there's a topographer who was doing maps, and he had this dirty, dusty room. And he said I could have it.
So that's where you set up shop?
That's where I set up shop.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. But I got myself in trouble there. I wasn't claiming my tax properly.
Uh-oh.
And some people were using it for tax write-offs.
Okay.
Reported me. And then I had to figure things out. That's the best way to put it.
Welcome back to real life.
right.
In terms of music now, where are we at this point?
I can go back to my high school days. We had grade 13 in high school when I was there at Parkdale Collegiate. Mm-hmm. So in grade 11, I started DJing out high school parties. And it was perfect because my uncle was giving me these records.
Oh, you had
those. Yeah, so I had all the hits. I had, whether it's Sly and the Family Stone, Curtis Mayfield, whoever. I had those hits.
Oh, you must have been popular.
And when I got to Toronto, it was a great year for me because it was the Babylon by Bus Tour from Bob Marley.
Oh.
It was the Montreal Olympics, 1976. And also I got to see Funkadelic and the Mothership, the Spaceship, in Shea Stadium in Buffalo.
Oh, boy.
So here I am in Toronto. Not really culture shocked because I was kind of hip to the kids and they thought I was kind of cool, I guess. And so I had a lot of friends and we traveled around a lot and muck around, going to different places around
mm-hmm.
the city. We'd even go to high school dances out in Scarborough. We went to Leslie B. Pearson, which had a studio. We went to Albert Campbell School to go to the parties there. So there were certain schools that had great parties that we used to go to. And otherwise, we had Ontario Place, which had shows for $5. So I got to see Gladys Knight and the Pips, Kool and the Gang.
For $5?
Rick James. You name it, we got to see them all.
And Toronto was starting to become much more diverse as well.
Yeah, but it's still considered like a small town compared to what it is now.
Oh, yes.
Like what's called Liberty Village now. We used to walk on the train tracks and play stickball, or we bring out 12-packs and drink some beer in the back and talk with each other. You know, we're talking about a good group of kids here. We're talking about easily 8 teenagers.
Oh, wow.
Like cruising the area. And now you can't even see where things were.
It's all gone.
All gone.
Yeah. So there was a time you're doing all this popular music, and then you became the jazz man. How did that happen?
Jazz happened in grade 12. I met a person by the name of Greg Gooding and also Terry Enman. And they were playing music that I wouldn't dare play now, but at the time it was sweet to my ears, you know, whether it's Spiral Gyro, Weather Report, groups like that, Mantaka. So I started off listening to jazz that way. My Coltrane, Miles Davis, Mingus stage came after that, came in university days. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, it was really popular jazz, you know, Najee, Grover Washington.
Sort of crossover music between popular and jazz.
And Harold Land, and, you know, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it gradually grew on you more and more as you went through.
That's right. Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if we're going to hear a tune or two at some point.
Oh, yeah. He's playing. We just have to turn the volume up, and I can talk about what he's playing, because these are all flashback memorabilia. So this is Lou Rawls, and the reason why I got into Lou Rawls is because I used to read a lot of liner notes, and Gamble and Huff was actually doing a lot of the recordings for Lou Rawls, along with another person my dad used to listen to by the name of Arthur Prysock. Do you know Arthur Prysock?
No, I don't.
Okay. So the first album I heard by Arthur Prysock was an album called This Is My Beloved. And my dad played it to, it was like worn out almost. So we heard it all the time. So the only time we were allowed in the front room, the only time we were allowed to in the front room to hear this music was on Sundays.
Sundays was the music day.
Yeah, Sunday late in the afternoon. Because earlier on in the afternoon, my mom was a soul sister. She had her friends, her dashiki wearing friends.
Oh boy.
Over, and they'd burn these weird incense all over the place and purple sand across the door. And stuff.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So we weren't allowed in the mornings there, but in the evenings we'd all get together as a family after supper.
And that's when the music started.
And we'd listen to stuff. And then later on, Jeff got a Ghetto Blaster, and we used to record things by listening, pausing, and making our mixtapes.
Mixtapes off the Ghetto Blaster.
Off the Ghetto Blaster.
Those were a job.
Yeah.
But they worked out nice. Once you put it on, you had everything you wanted just there in one spot. Mom sounds like an alternative lady at this point.
Yeah, as I said, my mom was really a workaholic. She was a matron in a hospital, so we hardly got to see her. And we sent for my grandmother from the Bronx to take care of us. So my mom left Jamaica, as I told you, when she was 16. So my dad was in England in 52. My mom was probably in England in 53. And the same time my dad moved to England, my grandmother left my grandfather and moved to the Bronx to look after some of her sons there, Uncle Dennis and Uncle Earl.
Oh, boy. So
And then she came over to take care of us when my mom was busy.
And even in Toronto now, you're...
And in Toronto now? No, Toronto now is different.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm talking about... We're talking 76 to about 80.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tremendous. 80. So you're moved... Then is Bishops after Toronto?
Yeah. Well, Bishops was 81 to 84.
84. Yeah. Okay.
So I left the house when I was 18, going on 19. And then I moved out to Lenoxville.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was quite a learning experience, I'm sure.
Well, in some ways, yes, but I traveled before that.
You'd been boarding school.
My parents would travel also. You know, my dad would get these these work packages where they'd go to Jersey, which is just on the tip of it, at the bottom of England.
Right.
And, you know, we'd go to places like that, or Genoa.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, in Switzerland and different places where, as I said, he'd get these work packages and he took the family. So I was traveling for a while. He's probably going to correct me right now. I know he's listening right now.
But there's a few. Today, Mr. Williams, you're free to call.
Yeah, there's a few other places that he took us to, but I can't recall right now. Mm. The ones I remember are mostly England and outside England, Scotland and whatnot.
But just to follow the flow, now you're in Bishop's. Right. The music down there wouldn't be exposed to the same kind of stuff you'd see in Toronto.
No, I was pretty much on the rebellious side, and then I was listening to a lot of alternative music. I was listening to groups like Fat Gadget and The Clash and,
oh my goodness,
and stuff like that.
What genre would that be? You've got me there.
Anything from punk to post-punk.
Okay.
And funk. I listened to a lot of funk.
Oh, yeah.
I figured it out before my friends did. I figured out funk was really dirty and erotic. and I was getting it. I was loving it.
Great.
Yeah.
And sharing it with your friends at Bishop's, I'm sure.
Some people didn't mind, or some people just didn't understand what it was all about. Like, hearing a song by Prince called Head, they're just singing the words, but weren't really paying attention to
what was going on.
What was going on.
Too much.
Right.
Tremendous. Eventually, you end up in radio.
Yeah. So radio for me was probably, I got in Montreal in 93. So radio for me was 88 onwards. Mm-hmm. I started off in Chin Radio, which is a multicultural station in Toronto. And I was there with a person by the name of Lawrence Fisher. We both played basketball together. And we were both inner city kids. He was at Jarvis Collegiate and I was at Parkdale. From there, I transferred over to CKLN, which is University of Ryerson. Mm-hmm. I took over Al Hill's show with Mr. Norris. This is the mixed bag. So the show they had before, prior to me, was a jazz show. And these guys were running a magazine called Coda.
Coda, yes.
Yeah, so I took over the show that these guys were running. And most of it was from the Sackville Collection, which is a Canadian label. And I just mixed it up. I was told I can do anything I want. So I said, all right, if I don't have to play just jazz, and I didn't want to play jazz, although I had to do Canadian content stuff, I ended up playing other things like, records by, Molly Johnson, for example, or Sarah Vaughan, and then some P-Funk, or, some Latin stuff,
So you really gave your listeners a broad spectrum of music.
And I was really getting into a lot of Latin music. I was listening to Lost Van Van at the time, Eric Keary, Pete Rodriguez, and, people like that.
Yeah. Now this is not the cutting-edge stuff, though. This is pretty straight, I think.
Yeah, to a certain extent, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When did you start moving?
Well, I start listening to, I think it's when I was actually finishing up university, I start listening to people like Cecil Taylor and others. Because, a lot of my friends weren't playing music like that. And then I decided I wanted to know what bebop was. And as I said to you earlier, I learned a lot from the liner notes. Liner notes was really crucial.
Oh, in those days, it was sometimes half a book.
Yeah. And I was explaining to some friends yesterday afternoon, the only thing I couldn't read off liner notes were hip-hop records, because hip-hop didn't have liner notes.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you'll never find a hip-hop record with liner notes.
What's that about?
Don't know what it's about. we're still trying to figure that out.
So you had to do all original research to get the background.
Well, it was through friends, and at the same time, what was going on in New York, it was going on in Toronto. The reason why is because hip-hop started at the same time in 78 in Toronto, because we'd have barbecues and we'd be playing the hottest things off the press, whether it's Curtis Blow or wherever we were playing it. At the same time, it was introduced in New York.
And although
it was the birthplace in New York.
And it's amazing how fast it caught on.
Yeah, because we all had a lot of West Indians, right? A lot of West Indians who had relatives in my relatives were in Queens, Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan.
That diaspora is incredible for getting this music around.
Well, Jamaicans everywhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You'll find Jamaicans everywhere.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Hip-hop sort of started to, not started, it really did move things around in terms of the popular music culture.
Right. One of the first labels I paid attention to was run by a woman by the name of Sylvia Robinson. Do you know Sylvia Robinson?
No, I don't.
Sylvia Robinson's a soul singer, and she ran Sugar Hill Records. And those were the most of the records that Sam the Record Man that were on sale. Like, within a month, you can find a Sugar Hill record for like $5.
Boy, we just dated ourselves there. I wonder how many people in this audience know what Sam the Record Man is.
Okay, yeah.
That was one big record store in Toronto.
Saturday mornings, you know, I'd go to the mall, buy my rosebuds, because I always ate chocolate rosebuds, and then go to the record store and buy my records. Buy, you know, one or two records here, plus records I had from my uncle.
And Sam had a collection, man.
Sam, yeah, it was huge.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But I've been to bigger stores.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to bigger stores.
Oh, yeah?
Amoeba is humongous. Have you been to Amoeba Records?
No, where was it?
There's two Amoeba Records that I went to. I went to one in San Francisco and one in L.A.
Oh.
And there are twice the sizes of Sam the Record Man. Huge.
You have to chain that credit card when you go into places like that, eh? Well, where to now? We've got you in Toronto. You've got two radio stations that you worked with. Are we covering the music?
Well, I've done lots of radio. I've done radio in Ibiza. I've done radio in Germany. I've done radio in England.
Oh boy!
I did a residency for 3 years in Cape Town.
Wow!
Called the Pan African Space Station.
Wow!
I've done Milk Audio in Toronto. I've done a radio slot in Japan.
That's tremendous. How do you make these connections?
Through friends who had the same similar interests.
Mm-hmm. And like, for instance, Cape Town.
Cape Town was, I was discovered by the two guys who ran Pan African Space Station. I had a compilation and an EP out, probably about 2008.
Oh yeah.
And they found me through a guy I used to work with, Nick. They said, "Well, do you know this Andy Williams guy?" And he gave them my particulars. And next thing you know, I was on the plane and I was part of the festival. And that was a crazy story, because when I got there, the place I performed at was my cousin's club.
Oh, really?
All the way in Cape Town.
In Cape Town.
Yeah.
Another
Jamaican, and we were friends. And we were childhood friends.
Oh man!
He was from Nottingham, and I was from Derby.
And tell us about this. What is it called? The Pan African Space Station.
Yeah, the Pan African Space Station was pretty much an alternative radio show, and it also had a festival. And every year we'd have different people come and speak to us, sort of like the Red Bull Music Academy.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was there for the 3 years, there's people like George Al Muldrow, jazz musicians, Tamani Diabate.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, people like that. Lots of different, right across the gamut, there's different types of musicians.
And you're doing your DJ.
I'm doing the DJing, and I also performed in the festival.
The
festival was only for 2 weeks. And that ran in October and November. And at the time, I didn't want to go back to grad school at McGill.
Ah.
So I quit and went down and chilled out with the South Africans, went down to Cape Town. And then we ran into my buddy, Tainer.
Our old friend, Tainer, who introduced me to radio a long time ago.
And he was part of the Pan African Space Station also.
Oh, he was involved too?
Yeah.
Excellent.
And then everyone got wind of it. You know, famous tastemaker in England called Giles Peterson. He was always there. Or Mos Def was always there. Or, you know, there's a whole bunch of people. It was pretty well known. It's a beautiful setup. They also ran a magazine called Chimurunga.
Oh, okay, Chimurunga, yeah.
Yeah, which was really well known in Africa.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
The Struggle.
Yeah.
Shona.
Those are the two guys who ran that magazine. They ran that festival.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we've got a little bit ahead of ourselves here, because we've got you in Toronto, or at least I had you in Toronto, and we jumped to Cape Town. How did you get to Montreal?
I just wanted to do my post-secondary education outside of Toronto. I got a little bored of Toronto.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I found Toronto at the time really dry, and my friends weren't really thinking the way I was thinking. I just wanted to change.
So you came here when?
I came here in 1993.
93?
Yeah.
And what'd you do?
Went to McGill for Teachers College for 2 years.
Oh.
Yeah. And then I ended up teaching at Westmont High. Then I went from Westmont High to Weston School, which was a private school. And then after Weston School, I went to the Lester B. Pearson School Board and taught at LaSalle Catholic High.
Oh, boy. So you did some line teaching for a number of years.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you were still involved with music.
That's right.
I think as soon as you got here, you got involved.
Oh, yeah. I was going to a place called Izart, which was down in Old Montreal.
Uh-huh. I remember them.
Yeah, it was an art collective. And that's where I met Scott C., my partner at the time. And we started playing with these two other guys called Similac and Simon Briscoe. And we created a group called Brass Knuckles.
Brass Knuckles?
Yeah, which was well-known in Montreal at the time. And the highlight of Brass Knuckles was hip-hop at 1 o'clock in the morning.
1 o'clock?
Yeah, prior to that, we'd be playing jazz, broken beat, two-step. But the crowd really came for the hip-hop at 1 o'clock.
And it came in numbers.
Yeah, and we did that for a while till 2002. And then Scott and I separated from the group and started our own night called The Goods, which lasted for 15 years at Sala Rosa.
The what?
The Goods.
Oh, The Goods, yeah. Which is what we're doing today.
Yeah, so we had the Goods Radio, and we also had The Goods. And what we did is we had different bands and different DJs from all over the world. So a lot of Brits. We had people like Mark DeClive Lowe. We had the Bugs in the Attic people. We had Nostalgia 77. We had Quantic. The list goes on. And then we had all of the California folks. Peter Butterwolf, Madlib. And it was a hot night because we had our top 10 list in Straight No Chaser, which was a British magazine.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of people got wind of us and started to call us and say, well, can we play your night? We're going to be in Toronto on Friday. Can we come and play with you on Saturday?
Oh, boy.
And we did this the last Saturday of every month.
Just across the road here?
Just across the road here for 15 years.
Oh, boy, well, that was a good gig.
Yeah.
And you kept the show going on the radio. Now, when did you get into CKUT? Let's get to CKUT. This is their oral history.
Yeah, CKUT was 1993. As soon as I got into town, I came here. A friend of mine, Bruce Tisdale in Toronto, told me, if you ever want to move to a new city, know your community radio. Mm-hmm. Reason why is because whether you're into punk or funk, you're going to find your crowd. And it happened that way. I got to meet so many people when I got here. At the time, Louise was still here. Pat Dillon was the station manager. Halid was spoken word. I'm missing a few people here.
Oh, yeah, well, 25-year-old memories.
So my first show was with Dr. Sean Moore. It was called Solo for Two Voices.
A Solo for Two Voices.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a great show. We played prison records that were done in prison, whether it was Johnny Cash or John Lee Hooker, and we had a great following for 5 years.
Your focus was prison?
Well, no, there were certain specialty shows that really took off and did well. Yeah, we did a great funk show. We did a show on everything. We did a show on Latin music. We did a gospel show. We did different types of genres throughout every Thursday. We were just before Amandla or after Amandla.
After
Mandela, yeah.
Well, I remember the Wednesdays with the Jazz Euphoria. Mm-hmm. When did you join?
And then, so 5 years with 5 years with Solo for Two Voices. Then I joined the Jazz Euphoria crew with Eric Lewis, John Braithwaite, Mike Chamberlain, Mark Chenard, and Gloria. I can't remember Gloria's last name now, but that was the show. And at the tail end of that, we had Kiva from Sala join us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's still going on. I haven't seen you there for a while.
Yeah, well, it changed a lot because when we started the show, it was a magazine show. So we'd have a theme. We had new listings. And then we would talk about things that were going on in the city.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's different now.
It's a little different now.
Mm-hmm. The show you're doing, The Goods, what is your mission there?
The Goods is mostly black music, so black diaspora of music. So we play anything from Afrobeat to funk. And right through the gamut of the black diaspora.
And that's been going how long now?
That's the 17th year now.
17th?
Yeah, it's going on 17th.
So while you're doing all these other things, you kept this thing going.
Just kept that going on.
Holy smokes, man. That's a full load, that's for sure. You've also produced a number of albums.
Yeah.
How many, in fact?
One was considered an EP because it's only four tracks, but it was all dealing with Thelonious Monk. It was called Monk Swing. So I got a poet from Toronto, Clifton Joseph, to give me a track. Carmen Lotus, who are hip-hop folks here. And then I had Val Maniget, who passed away, rest in peace. And we did a few remixes on that EP. And then I had an album with various groups from Sonny Babusa to Amari Baraka to Avram Pfeffer, who's a saxophonist from New York. And that was probably a 10-track album.
Oh, yeah.
And all the proceeds went to Tyndall St. George. At the time, I just left Tyndall. I was filling in for Kim Kidder. She was on maternity leave, and so I took over the job as the educational coordinator.
Well, let's just step out in music and radio then and go there, because there you were a teacher for a long time. How many years did you do teaching?
I wasn't a teacher there. I was writing.
No, but you were a teacher.
In total, in education, it's 18 years.
18 years. Yeah. Then George, Tyndall.
Tyndall, I was the educational coordinator for 2 years, and I was just setting up the program for the kids for after school. And bringing in a lot of people from heavyweight.
And I know you did some work at Vanier College.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I worked at Vanier College for a year with Guy Quinn.
Guy Quinn in the educational.
And, I did an outdoor education course called Science of Survival. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing. Because in the daytime, we'd have the kids learn the three, the core courses. And then we had different courses like botany and whatnot. And then we went into the forest on Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Try to challenge them a little bit.
Yeah, and they're all kids from the West Indies or European immigrants.
A mixed background.
Yeah. And Guy was amazing with those kids. Mm. Yeah, so I learned a lot with that. And I preferred working at Vanier as opposed to teaching math. Math was really difficult here in Quebec.
Oh, yeah.
The classes are overstocked. Some of my classes had 40 students.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. With a 45-minute period, you can't really. All you can do is take up one or two problems on the board, and then you make circles with the kids, weak kids with strong kids, and then you just move around. So it was like each kid was like a talking stick.
Yeah. But you had St. George Tyndall.
Yeah.
Tyndall St. George. That was a whole other experience. Now what they had another objective going on there. They served the refugee community.
That's right.
Communities at risk and at a disadvantage.
That's right. Yeah.
And but then you ended up at McGill.
Yeah, McGill. I first started off doing radio journalism. And it was all about, it was kind of a bogus course. It was all about CRTC rules and all that. And then I switched over to doing jazz courses. I got a student right here sitting in front of us.
Okay.
I did a course called The Diaspora of Jazz. I did a course called Jazz and the Civil Rights Movement. And then I did a course called Black Oral Traditions to Hip Hop.
Okay, cool. So there we are. We've done. Got our educational work going on. We're doing our musical career at the same time. I guess sports has sort of fallen off the calendar for you a bit.
I had a terrible accident in sports, and I patched it in when I was 32.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I broke my kneecap and tore my patella tendon, and I had 3 ACL surgeries.
Oh, those are no fun.
So. As you probably know, I walk with a limp, and I'm just happy to be walking.
No, yeah, after surgeries really do have to think about it. Well, I think we're going to put on a little bit of music for while here and take a small break.
Yeah, okay.
Welcome back, Andy. What was that song, and what do you like about it?
Thelma Houston. Those were pretty much my disco days, and that started for me at 17. I got introduced to disco through some of my gay friends, the LGBT community, and I ended up going to clubs at 17 and making the mistake one day of telling my right age,
and I was that's the last time.
So I was going to clubs where PWDs in Toronto was known for having lots of pimps. I went there. These Eyes had a lot of pimps. I went there. I went to Sparkles at CN Tower at nighttime. We drive sometimes from Toronto to Buffalo.
Oh, boy.
To New York, and then drive back for last call.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So we're doing, like, crazy stuff as youngsters, you know?
Sounds
and,
exciting.
And most of the tracks that you heard earlier, and the disco stuff, was always around Toronto. It was like, as you know, it's a big, big gay community in Toronto, and big, beautiful clubs.
Oh yeah,
all the good clubs in Toronto were the gay clubs, or you'd go to These Eyes, Twilight Zone, and then later on for me it became the alternative scene, a club by the name of Nuts and Bolts.
Well, you know, your little motto or slogan is, if you're not on the edge, you're taking up too much space. And I think just what you're telling us right now is about being on the edge. Why do you use that?
I always beg to differ. A lot of my friends will play tracks that they want to please the crowd, and I want to just introduce stuff that's always fresh, because it's, and Scott was the same way. My partner was always the same way. There's so many records out there. So why would I want to play something that I hear at home or hear on the radio? It's not my thing. It's never been my thing.
So you're a teacher forever, going to bring people into new experiences, try and move them past their comfort zone?
Well, there's all these little subcultures, right? So so for the Broken Beat crowd, they would know some of the stuff I'm playing. Or for the hip-hop crowd, they'd know some of the stuff I'm playing. But I'm not going to play, like, a Tribe Called Quest song. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 or 3 weeks in a row. It's no way. And my friends and DJs who know me, they know I'm not going to do that. I'm always going to do something different.
Now, DJs, you make a big point when we were talking about telling me that DJ culture or types, genre, have evolved enormously. Give us a little bit of background on what you see is out there and what you do by comparison.
When I started off as a DJ, the word disc jockey meant something. I was actually jockeying the disc for the radio shows. I was in a DJ pool. I was getting records from the. I was getting vinyl from the record pool, from one of my friends named Senor Ezekiel, and we were hustling. We're getting the records out. We're promoting. You know, we're helping out the musician or the station or.
So how has that evolved to today?
It's not the same anymore. We don't really have that culture anymore. Before, we get a lot of records from the record labels to the stations, but now it's all MP3s and CDs, and we don't even have CDs that much anymore. Once in a while, how many CDs do you guys get per week, you'd say?
Way down.
So when I first came to CKT, I was one of the volunteers that would actually sort through records, and I loved it because I'd get to hear the new Fella track or King's Sunny A Day track and all that. And as you know, it's not like that anymore. We don't have that kind of...
It's a tactile something missing, isn't there?
Yeah, something's missing.
It's very much so.
Well, it's because of the EDM, which is EDM stands for electronic dance music. And... When you're listening to records, it's actually a cone, so you can actually get the sound where it actually surrounds the room, and it's a warm the warm sound. CDs and MP3s are lasers, dude, so it's really sharp, and the EDM style of electronic music, it's pretty much a beat with a big, hard bang, boom, 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 and that came from the rave culture, which I totally missed out on.
Oh, yeah.
I was never involved in a rave culture.
Went right by you.
It went right by me.
Why would you not have?
Because I was listening to funk. I was listening to a bunch of other things and going to basement parties. So when I was going to basement parties and all that, a lot of the kids were doing raves.
So you've kept the faith with vinyl, and yeah, it's come full vinyl. Circle now full because circle. Vinyl's become popular. They're starting
That's
to
right.
press more.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I think what we can do at this point is start asking our friends in the audience here if they have any questions. We have a microphone up here. Please come and take it. As soon as I see somebody with it, I'll pass the word over to them. Andy, in the meantime, I like the show that I do, Amanda, focus a lot on Africa. You've been to Africa, but you said you went to West Africa first, and your Griot experience was very special for you.
My first countries were Nigeria, Ghana, and Senegal.
And when did you do that?
1988 to about 1995.
Oh, quite a while ago.
Yeah.
And what struck you?
I was collecting a lot of stories and footage and from my own archive and hanging out with griots in these countries.
As a personal thing.
A personal thing.
And how do you feel that shaped what you're looking at now?
It helped to the extent where I found that I was learning a lot about my roots, my African roots, and I realized that there's a lot of stuff we weren't even touching or talking about in North America.
Yes.
Yeah. So even the way we eat is different than how Africans eat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I was in Senegal, for example, we eat in a circle. And we're all dipping from the same bowl, the same plate.
Mm-hmm.
Ethiopia's like that too.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was eating, what's the name of the green
injera.
Dog? Injera. Where we take the injera, and there's about 10 of us, and we just grab it with the meat and eat it, right? in North America, we don't eat that way.
We don't.
Yeah. And sometimes it was totally strangers. Yeah, we don't have,
no difference.
Yeah, it was totally different in a while.
And in terms of musical traditions, what did you come up with there?
Mostly high life and a lot of juju and Congolese rumba.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And have you been following those through?
Yeah. I've been collecting 45 since I've been going back. I've been touring as a DJ, so when I go to England or Europe, I collect African 45s.
So they're still available, though?
It's still available. Well, yeah, it's hard to find, and they're getting more expensive because there's these tastemakers that jack the prices up. There's a few people here in Canada, in Toronto, Montreal, they're spending anywhere from $200 to $400 on a 45.
Ooh.
Yeah.
The vinyl is back.
Yeah. And I've got some of those records that I could probably sell for that kind of money, but it's not my thing.
No.
Yeah.
You're going to use them.
Yeah.
Tremendous. The music scene today, generally, how do you see it? Where are we at?
Montreal's more about the indie scene and electronic scene, and it's not really covering a lot of black music. When I say black music, it's not really covering a lot of soul music. It's not even covering electronic music from blacks in England, like the broken beat scene. So I find it a little narrow-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I head out on tour, usually in Europe and stuff, I'm hearing all sorts of stuff. But when I'm in Montreal, and a lot of people can attest to this, it's mostly whatever, Godspeed or Arcade Fire or Plants and Animals or Do May Say Think or,
So Montreal's lost its cutting edge a little bit?
We do have a crew called Carminity, and they do things, and that's organized organic improv and stuff, and it's kind of cool. I guess organizing improv camp. Okay, so organic improv. And that's kind of cool, but it's not as big as the indie scene or the electronic scene in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Nobody picked up that mic yet.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I should mention is that Sala Rosa here has a festival called the Swanee. which is really well done.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's it's suited to my likings.
What's that more about?
A lot of avant-garde music, a lot of progressive jazz.
And you're still pushing this kind of alternative stuff as well.
Absolutely.
Are you playing it?
Yeah. Even on the dance floor.
Okay.
For example, there's a few Marshall Allen tracks from an album called Bow Square, which are awesome for the dance floor. Otherwise, I'd be playing jazz records from people like Art Farmer, Mau Mau, or Art Blakey's Ping Pong, or Ahmad Jamal's Optical Solutions.
So you really are still doing the cutting edge and pushing the limits.
Yeah. Well, I'm involved with it's a duo. It's myself and Lou, DJ Love from Ninja Tune. We have a duo called Jazz Amnesty Sound System.
Oh, yeah.
So we put mixes up on Mixcloud and we play around. We get together with groups like Thievy Corporation in Washington, D.C. We play at B-flat in New York.
So the Jazz Amnesty Sound System is still on?
It's still on in Montreal.
Okay.
Yeah, but we take it on the road.
Okay.
Usually.
Tell us more about that one.
We do a dance floor night, which is all dance floor jazz. We've done a night at the Contemporary Art Museum called Living Inside Jazz, where we have music from the mid-century to go along with mid-century furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 800 people show up to that.
Oh, boy.
And that was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. We do a thing called Jazz Mass, where we have the Maha Choir and a lot of musicians from the indie scene. And then Lou and I on turntables playing sort of like spiritual instrumental stuff.
Wow.
And then musicians will come up and play their instrument and along with the choir. And then we also do Evolution of Jazz. So the records from Evolution of Jazz is from 1889 the last time we did it was 2016. So 1889 to 2016.
Okay. I'm just wondering, like, we just critiqued the music scene, but where do you think music will be going next? We've seen quite a few things happening over the last while, but I'm not the kind of person who can talk about it like you can. Tell me.
I'm not really sure. Right now we're stuck on this EDM thing, which is kind of like gray music, gray matter.
I know.
It's not really my thing. So I'm back to the old stuff.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'm going back deeper and deeper now. Back to, like, Louis Jordan and you know, like, the doo-wop scene and the old R&B scene. And that's how Montreal really started off, because Montreal was never a jazz town. It was a jazz town at night for after hours. But the music that Oliver Jones and those guys were playing was definitely rhythm and blues. And then one of our famous groups that put out a funk album, the Hot Tamales, was run by this guy that we discovered through a friend of mine, Jerome, to see DJ Cobal. Was run by a person by the name of Kenny Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the number one track for a while for DJ culture, because it was emulating James Brown, but it had a different twist to it, because the singer, Kenny Hamilton, was more of a soul, it had more of a soul vibe.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a lot of James Brown screaming, there wasn't, you know, it was pretty much straight funk.
So much of this alternative music comes out of community radio, eh?
Right.
And do you think we're doing it properly?
Once again, as I just told you, it's all been about the indie scene.
Mm-hmm.
and a little bit of folk. But I do listen to other shows on CKT that I like. I like the Bluegrass Show on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to that sometimes. New shit is really cool, because you're getting to know certain things that you don't really hear. I listen to Wee Funk on Fridays sometimes if I'm home. Utopia Paradise, which is mostly house music and disco. There's shows like that, you know. West Indian Rhythms at times.
Okay.
Yeah. Boom Boom Time.
Okay, well, I think we're going to listen to one of these next songs.
There was a question.
Oh, we do have a question. Oh,
Peter, you had a question?
If you could just get the mic there.
Hi, Andy. And hi. I've been enjoying the interview. Andy, I know you spent time in the UK more recently. Like, you know, you're talking about Derby and all that. So I think you spent time in Bristol. Or also with Banksy somehow?
That was in Brighton.
In Brighton, yeah. Okay. Anyway, I was curious to hear about that.
Well, my home base when I go to England was in Brighton. I'd stay in Brighton. And my friend Miles Clarett, who runs his label called Soundway Records, told me that he was going to a wedding. And I was there by myself for 2 weeks. He said, there's going to be a gentleman coming here. And he's going to have a dog, if you don't mind his dog, which was a gigantic Rhodesian Ridgeback. And I spent 2 weeks with this person without even asking him his last name. And he gave me his first name. It was cool. And we were hanging out. We cooked together. We went for walks together and did the truth, you know, go down to the True Thoughts label, Catskill label. So one day we went up for a big trek on the upper mount area of Brighton. And he said to me, do you know who I am? And I said, well, I just know that you're a friend of Miles. And he goes, I'm a famous artist. And they call me Banksy. At the time, I didn't know who Banksy was. And then I came back to Montreal and asked who Banksy was. And then I found out very quickly.
After the fact.
Very, very quickly who Banksy was. Yeah.
Wow, that man's had an impact, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I've had lots of great stories out in England. Hanging out with Fergal Sharkey from the Undertones. You know, that was cool. Sonny from the Funkees, Rico from the Rico and the Rudy All-Stars. I've hung out with those cats in England.
Well, in terms of jazz, with all these years of playing their music, have you run into many of the artists?
I've done lots of jazz interviews. I did a concert with Archie Shepp in Bordeaux.
Oh, really?
And what I had to do is bring animal sounds and industrial sounds. It was all special effects type of stuff, and he was just blowing his horn. And Archie Shepp can be like that. He can be, you know, he came from the drama community. He's a drama student.
Oh, yeah?
Before he was a jazz thing. So he was always into being, as dramatic is the word.
Yeah.
So I'd play, like, bird tweets for him and little, you know, little snippets from different library records. And he would just
riff along with it. Oh, that's cool.
And that was a great gig for me. It was like probably one of my easiest gigs.
Did you say Bordeaux?
Yeah, Bordeaux, France.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Any other big names you've run across?
I've done stuff with David Murray. I've done stuff with Cahill El-Zabar. I've done... I was an agent for a while for Billy Robinson for about 4 years.
Oh, yes.
And that wasn't easy because he didn't want to play in clubs that were smoky.
No, in those days, it was tough to find those clubs.
He didn't drink alcohol. He didn't want to be in clubs where it was smoky, and it had to be venues where it was just like a church hall or auditorium, and it had to be clean. He's a very meticulous guy, but at the same time, I got it, and
he played some great music. Yeah,
and he was well known because he was one of the last Texas tenors.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And
he moved from Texas, I believe, to Montreal. Then he moved to Ottawa after that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's no longer with us. Rest in peace.
Oh, that's so sad to hear.
Yeah.
So sad to hear. Let's just unless there are more questions. Yes, please.
Andy, I know you've accumulated a huge record collection over the years, but I've heard you made one or two oblique references to the fact that you also have developed quite a collection of jazz films. And maybe you could talk a little about that, because I know nothing about that. Yeah. Where does one go about getting them? And in the pre-YouTube days, what were these things made for?
Yeah. Well, it was just my own private collection, and I wanted to, you know, make sure that people can use it if they want. For example... Burgundy Jazz. There's Burgundy Jazz folks here in Montreal. They've used some of the stuff. Professor Eric Lewis. Eric's not here. Eric's used some of my stuff. So it's for the takings if you want. It's there. If you got a project and I've got what you want. Like, for example, I've done Steve Lacy, David Murray. I've got over 175 musicians on cassettes, from cassettes to high 8 to super 8, the whole gamut.
So, yeah. And how do you make those available to people?
They have to come up and ask me.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah. Well, it'd be great if get that out, that's for sure. Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. You also did a gig at the Montreal Museum of Contemporary Art, eh?
Yeah, that was the gig I was telling you about earlier. That was called Living Inside Jazz.
Oh, that's
yeah,
the one.
Yeah,
okay.
That's Living Inside Jazz. So what we did is we had music that we played upstairs, but downstairs there was a setup of all mid-century furniture, and there's overhead on every couch that if you were hearing a track that you wanted to hear upstairs, you just grab this silver template and you put it towards the projector and it'll show you the album you're playing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so we did that with Mark Morgenstern. And then we had 50 monitors in a circle of videos, film, photography of jazz.
Oh, that's
it. So that kept, you know, so it kept people busy. And then there was magazines on the coffee tables, you know, whether it's Downbeat or Coda or Jazz Is.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite the show.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
Absolutely.
You mentioned earlier being a part of a record pool. Maybe you could explain what a record pool is to
right.
everyone and just what that was about. I forget which city that was in, but maybe you could describe.
Yeah. So the person who was running the record pool, his name was Signal Ezekiels. We lived in Scarborough, and he'd have every second week he'd have a new stock of records for me to play on the radio, and most of it was 12 inches or R&B or funk, and then I'd present that to my radio audience, mm-hmm. or some of it was good enough to play on the dance floor.
So what?
I felt pressure to play some of them. Yeah, I did, because I had to fill out these sheets. And so the sheets would say, good, very good, not good, or whatever to your likings. And then I'd have to put the genre, just like how I was doing at CKT with collecting the CDs and going over the CDs.
Mm-hmm. And why is it called a pool?
These were records that the distribution companies were giving.
Ah, okay.
And then you'll see that around a lot. You'll see records in record stores that will say, promotional use only.
Mm-hmm.
We were getting those records.
Okay.
The ones with the promotional use only.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that a lot at CKUT when CDs were popular. We'd have new releases in the studio. We'd have three or four shelves of African new releases, and now we get a little four or five slot. So I guess they're just not coming out like that.
Have you checked out the African collection of CKT? There's still a...
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I still go through it. Oh, yes, regularly. And there's still some very good music in there. Mm. Excellent. I haven't looked through the vinyl.
It's all a good vinyl, that's what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah.
So what I remember is the record pool was sort of a subsection of the industry where they asked the music director still that... charts are very important, and you report what you're playing, and therefore you get the servicing. But there was a whole subsection that was just for the DJs that were working DJs,
right.
And so it was a way of getting feedback, but right. also a way of putting pressure.
Right.
Which is why the individual DJs would get their own servicing. But what I wanted to ask you about was bringing Muta Baruka, Barefoot and All, to Montreal for the Black History Month series that you did just last February.
Right.
Barefoot in February, just if you didn't catch that part. I know that was a real vision of yours and kind of conceived from the bottom to the top, like the entire kind of.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you... what that experience was like, and if there's some other ideas that you're itching to do.
Well, the funny thing about that is that people thought I just did that one gig, and I've been doing it for like 16 years. I've always done a Black History Month series, but it was mostly with jazz. So this time I switched it up, and I don't want to be slagging people here, although they're listening on air right now. I can never get along with the West Indian community in terms of organizing those shows. It was like the most atrocious thing. I'd say, 3 months from now, I'll have Muta Baruka, blah, 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 blah. And they're like, we'll get back to you. Then you call a month later, we'll get back to you. So I said, you know what? I'm going to do my own thing. So I got together with Never Apart and rented their gallery and did my own thing. Prior to that, it was mostly Canada Council grants and, my dad helping out sometimes.
We got something you're still itching to do, someone you would like to bring, or?
Yeah, there's a collection of art from the Jurgens family I'd like to introduce to Montreal at a gallery. There's a poetry thing I'd like to do with Saul Williams and a bunch of other people from the age of 18 to about 16 to show the different folks in African-American poetry. I'd like to do that coming up. I've already finished writing the proposal, so now it's time for me to check out TD Bank and see if they'll accept it. And there's also a concert I like to do with a sitar player by the name of Hishad Khan, who now lives in Toronto.
A concert, you say? What would that be in terms of?
Indian music.
Okay, sitar, of course.
Sitar, yeah.
And here in Montreal?
That's right, yeah. Because he's now living in Montreal. Mm-hmm. I mean, Toronto.
Okay.
Which is like, you know, stones throw away.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Let's take one more musical break. We'll shut the mics for a few minutes.
Thank you. future. Gonna be back again. And all this confusion. Gonna be back. It's just an illusion.
Okay, welcome back. We're here at CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. This is The Goods Show, and I'm Doug Miller, co-hosting today with the host that owns the show, Andy Williams, because we're part of the CKUT the time capsule setup they're trying to do is sort of an oral history. They're reflecting back on their 30 years as a station and looking at some of the people who have contributed to make CQT is one of the alternative for everything. Music, news, culture. It always wins awards in the Mirror's gone now, but it was always one of the best stations listened to by so many people. And Andy Williams has been very much part of that. So CQT is part of their time capsule oral history is getting people that have contributed to tell their stories. And that's what Andy's been doing today. And we're getting a lot of it. So I don't even know where to continue now, Andy, but I'm going to start by talking about how the fact that you've traveled a lot and that you've got a lot more touring. How do you feel this touring influences you and helps you?
Actually, it's changed a lot now. Back in the day when I started touring was pretty much 95 onwards, and it was all specialty gigs. Going to England and playing a jazz cafe as a funk DJ or opening up for a band, and I had certain musicians and DJs I would tag along with and do these gigs. Nowadays, you need to have a portfolio. It can be an EP, it can be one track, and that's your portfolio, and then people want to hear those tracks, so you go on tour with those tracks.
Now
whether the tours are the club scene or the festival scene.
So when you do a scene, then you're on for the evening. You've got your show and you present.
Yeah, but before that, I was all over the place. I would be doing a disco set in Germany or doing a house set in Chicago or I'd be doing those events and those kind of specialty shows are over now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you've got to have a portfolio now.
And so you're being invited as a person with your
with something.
Something to show.
Yeah, show.
Perfect. You taught courses at McGill.
Right.
What were they?
Well, the Diaspora Jazz Show, course was pretty much all about various forms of jazz, whether it's avant-garde jazz, whether it's Latin jazz, African jazz, and institutions. Whether it's, for example, whether it's Temple University having a 24-hour radio show, whether it's Yale University with the photography archive, whether it's, Columbia University with two well-known radio shows,
mm-hmm.
and, different things for the diaspora jazz in terms of style and genres and subcultures. Jazz and the civil rights movement was a little different. It was we were playing records from the civil rights movement days. For example, Hymn of Freedom by Oscar Peterson, to Fable of Farbus by Charles Mingus, to Randy Weston, like different people that had political commentary or narratives in their mm-hmm. in their music that I could actually
excellent. One thinks more of gospel when one thinks of the civil rights music, but jazz too.
Yeah. And then there was the Black Royal Traditions, which was dealing with anything from signifying monkey to black poetry of African folklore to various poets from Leopold Senghor right up to Saul Williams. Wow. And then there's Hip Hoppers, Tupac, and a few others.
So you did cover hip hop those courses.
Yeah.
Excellent,
yeah.
Excellent. How do you feel they received the students? How did they take it?
Well, the jazz diaspora class, we had 40 students, and then the jazz and the civil rights movement course were varied. The first year it was really heavy, and then the second year was probably about 20 students, you'd say? Oh, in the diaspora class, the second year, yeah. So the first year was 40. Second year for the diaspora, it started to drop to about 15. It's because the courses were expensive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then the Black Oral Traditions course was pretty much around 20 to 30. And then, once again, the numbers dropped and dropped until they folded the program.
Okay. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
That's really too bad because it is an important component of what's, you know.
Those courses were probably about 3 and change, I think, 400, which is a lot of money.
Okay.
Yeah,
so you think perhaps the money would put it out of reach of people?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, that's too bad because it's really, really an important contribution to keeping and improving the knowledge about Black culture here in Montreal, that's for sure. You mentioned something about Thread the Needle. What is that?
That's the latest project I'm working on, and I've only done a few tracks. What I've done is I've taken samples from a record, and then I get a musician or a programmer to work around that beat. So far, I got one track from Drea Parks. I've got both tracks are unfinished. I got a track from a person by the name of Quantic, and we're just working on that. I'm working on that to just try to see if I can get 10 good tracks to do an album.
So what'll be the theme of that album in total?
The theme, Thread the Needle, which is pretty much adding on to the sample.
Okay.
And creating something out of the sample.
So you take a sample and you build on it.
And you build on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. When we talked about influences, give us a little bit of a spectrum now from A to Z.
In the beginnings, it would be Jimmy Savile from England, because I was always listening to Jimmy Savile from the 60s onwards. Then it became John Peel. And then when I got to Jamaica, we were listening to Soul Train with Don Cornelius, because we were getting it through, because, you know, Jamaica is like 90 miles away from Miami, and we were hearing all the American stuff. So Soul Train, American Bandstand, Saturday Night, is it called Saturday Night Live with Wolfman Jack, and a few others. And then all the other influences were mostly DJs that I've met over the years.
Mm-hmm.
One guy was by the name of Malik X, David Kingston, they're both from Toronto. David Kingston's from Toronto. And then some American DJs that I fell in love with, DJ Spinner, and then a lot of British guys, Keb Darche, Bob Jones from England. So yeah, I had my head and my fingers on all different sorts of music. But once again, I said to you earlier, the liner notes were very key.
Oh yeah,
on me finding out where to go next.
Well, and there you are back to England, and it's a real hotbed of energy when it comes to new music and pushing music. Yeah. Where's the West Indian culture there in India, in England rather?
Where are they? They're mostly in the Midlands.
Yeah,
right?
But in terms of the clubs and the scene and the music, is it as original as all the other music that we expect to come out?
Absolutely. My folks used to go to a place called the Normanton Hotel in Derby.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to another place in Nottingham called, it was in the Saddlegate district, but I can't remember the name of the club. But, you know, they got dressed up for those things.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about wearing your Sunday best and getting dud up, you know. And, you know, my mom would say to me, come here, Andy, zip me up, you know, zipper, dress up and stuff, and they're ready to go. And then, I had my babysitter, Mary Carter, who was this old English-British woman, and her German husband, Wenzel. They take care of me. Meanwhile, my folks would go out and party and spend the night in Nottingham or Derby or Birmingham,
wow,
wherever. So the West Indian community definitely had a flow of clubs around the Midlands.
and contributed to that dynamic mm-hmm. culture that was the overall British scene.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Jamaica, you were talking about hearing music from 90 miles away in Miami
right.
and in Toronto from mm-hmm. Buffalo. That American scene had its influence that was way beyond its
absolutely.
Own borders.
Yeah.
And in the same sort of way, mm-hmm. Powerful those stations mm-hmm. and how they influenced us. I can remember our little crystal radios and mm-hmm. listening in with that earbud. That was probably a little bit before you. Who do you think you have influenced over the years and how?
Oh, that's a good question. There's about four or five of us that we influence each other.
Mm-hmm.
DJ Cobalt, Scott C., Miles Flurit, Quantic. There's a whole bunch of us that we pass things on to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say personally I was, the tastemaker of the crew. I think we're all tastemakers.
And cutting on the edge.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always been a teamwork thing. Like
yeah,
it's
always been like that.
Good stuff. Where do you see it moving now? What's the next one? Well, I've talked about some of your projects.
Yeah. I'd like to get back into the blues and learn more about the blues.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In regions. I like to do, now that's pretty easy with Mississippi Records and a few labels that are out there, mm-hmm. And, Tony Schwartz and people like that, they put stuff out that I can follow. I'm sort of gearing towards that, but I know it's going to be pretty expensive. Collecting records has always been expensive.
Always expensive, yeah. Yes. And where do you keep them?
Yeah.
They fill up walls.
Well, I've got cabinets at home that were made for records.
Mm.
Yeah. And condensers.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. How many records do you think you own?
Now it's down to 5,000 LPs, 5,000 45s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Down to?
Well, my first place I lived in, which was on Park Avenue, Park and Bernard, I probably was up to about 12. I had two closets full of records, and then records were everywhere else in the house.
Wow.
And then I started getting rid of them with a guy named Bob Olivier from Montreal, a musician. We had record sales and got rid of a lot of records.
Oh, okay. So you started to thin it out
down
a little
size,
bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that stuff was mostly post-punk stuff and a lot of 12 inches. And it's funny, now I feel like having some of those records back. I feel like having some of those post-punk records back. So,
be careful what you sell, is it?
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things.
Too much. Let's have another.
All right.
Let's have another piece here. What are we listening to?
So this record, Freeze, is by a group called IOU. And is it We Got the Jazz? Yeah. So this is stuff where I was getting into a lot of punky stuff, but it was like punky jazz, punky disco, punky, everything. And the club I used to go to was called Nuts and Bolts. And then a couple years after that, I graduated to one of the most famous house music venues and clubs in Toronto and pretty much North America, called the Twilight Zone, which was on Richmond Street.
And it's still going?
No, it's not.
No, not anymore. I never realized punk covered other than punk.
Patti LaBelle was punk.
Oh, yeah.
Patti LaBelle, Nona Hendrix, Grace Jones.
So that was
all punk. That's black punk.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's, rock coalitions of black singers, mm-hmm. Like Living Color.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So,
Wow. Mm. It's contributed so much. The black musicians, the black community of all sorts, in its many, many stripes, has contributed so much to popular culture in so many ways. How do you see that?
Because of the polyrhythms, right? There's a lot of polyrhythms, and that's what's kept people going, and that's what gave us a lot of different styles of music, as opposed to classical, which is pretty much just on a pentatonic...
A straight line.
Yeah, straight line of pentatonic scale, diatonic scale, as opposed to black music, which is, pentatonic scale.
and a straight line instead of the cycles and circles that go around and go around. It's been a powerful influence the way it's done so much like jazz.
Well, there you go. Jazz on itself is, you know, as Archie Jepp once told me, making something out of nothing.
Well, and as the Jazz Festival here will attest, it's so many things. It's not one thing. Everything from Zydeco to
I don't really consider that a jazz festival. It's what's hot and what's out there to sell. I couldn't believe it one year. One year, George Thurgood was here and Chris DeBurr.
Well, that's not jazz. You're stretching the name jazz, that's for sure.
So it's all about record sales.
It
changed a lot. There's certain communities and provinces that kept it going. The Edmonton Jazz Festival was really good. Ken Pickering, who just died last week, rest in peace, in Vancouver. That was a good jazz festival. The Guelph Festival in Guelph, Ontario. It's a good festival.
Guelph?
Yeah. And right here in Montreal, Swanee, right in this place here.
What is it?
The Swanee Il Popolo.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yeah. And that's pretty much it for jazz. There's hardly any more jazz clubs in Toronto. The Montreal Bistro's gone. Train Studio's gone. There's only a few.
In fact, it's become a major problem, the finding small sets where groups can play, and those clubs just can't pay the rents anymore.
Before you had Top of the Center, you had Bermuda Onion, all those clubs, and they're no longer existing. Yeah. Back in the day when I was probably 17, 18, I was going to George's Spaghetti House to hear Archie Lane or Ed Bickett or famous Montrealist Sonny Greenwich or, you know, people like that. We don't get to see these people play anymore.
Oh, I know.
Norm Villeneuve, who just actually moved to Montreal, he was playing at George's Spaghetti House as the house drummer.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I can even remember Charlie Biddle's place.
Yeah.
I mean, what's happened to that? I have no idea. Is it still performing?
He passed away.
No, I know he passed away, but the jazz.
It's called the House of Jazz, and I don't really. Yeah, it's a tourist haven now.
It's not doing its original function. Used to be so much fun to go listen to Charlie and the old boys.
Yeah.
I think some of the guys were so old that Charlie would crack the joke about them getting a probation from the nursing home to come and play.
Yeah. And to surprise you, that wasn't even Charlie Bill's club. They just used his name.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
Yeah,
it's really been a problem trying to keep jazz alive outside of the big festival, which, you, as you say, isn't really a jazz festival anymore.
Yeah. Well, the question is, you know, and you can ask a lot of people who are trying to say they know jazz. What is jazz? That's the question.
That's the question.
Yeah.
Well, what is jazz?
It's improvised music, and mostly, you know, predominantly black in terms of. Where it started and the birthplace and from bebop to whatever, but you know, you speak to people about jazz and they really can't really give you a good answer.
Or like some of my children, I don't listen to jazz, I don't like jazz, and yet I don't think they know what it is.
I saw a sign yesterday saying that jazz is dead.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, is it dead? I don't know.
I'm still listening.
Yeah.
What are we listening to now?
Confunction. One of my favorite songs by Confunction, which is an R&B funk group, is Straight from the Heart, which is a slow jam. I used to listen to a show on WBLK Buffalo called The Quiet Storm, and it was all about that. It was all about slow music and how it came from just regular R&B to slow music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just going through R&B now. Where do you fit it into the musical lexicon with...
Well, there's different styles in R&B.
Yeah, absolutely.
Old R&B would be Louis Jordan and those guys, and nowadays R&B is Beyonce and all that, which to me is not rhythm and blues.
Nope.
But the label that's put onto that music is rhythm and blues.
So, where would you draw the limit then?
I don't really get to hear R&B anymore.
No,
rhythm and blues anymore. Rhythm and blues.
Yeah.
No, Have you?
Are you playing it?
No.
No.
Rhythm and blues is, well, I just told you. Mm-hmm. Rihanna, Beyonce.
Oh, I'm not.
I don't really listen to pop culture music.
Turn the radio off when that comes in.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, that's one of the first Afrobeat tracks made. That was done in 1972 by Manu Dibango.
Oh, that's the...
Sol Makosa.
Sol Makosa.
Yeah, and it's been sampled by Michael Jackson, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's... Well, he got sued for that, actually.
Sol Makosa. I mean, Manu Dibango was one of the first to bring that scene to world attention.
So a lot of people thought that Fela was the first Afrobeat person, but he wasn't. It was Manu Dibango, Sonny Okusin, and Orlando Julius were some of the first Afrobeat.
And out of Ghana, we had the likes of, I'm missing a name here, an amazing funk band in the early 70s, Fusion. They were really great. OCBISA,
yeah.
They put together some beautiful
stuff. But OCBISA was more Afro rock.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
But it was that lovely.
Yeah, but it did have a little
fusion.
Bit of Afro beat, yeah.
It was just amazing.
Yeah.
That's hypnotic, eh?
Yeah.
That really just. We would dance to that.
I wanted to just ask, because we have 15 minutes, for you to talk a little bit. You've always been involved with the politically conscious activist scene in Montreal. From the MOM, you know, Izart had a political conscious ethos. Not all clubs do. So what were the issues and what was your relationship with that scene? How do you think it's evolved or devolved?
Devolved, yeah. The things I got myself involved with a person by the name of Fon Ami was that a lot of black kids in Montreal were actually getting ticketed for being around the metros, loitering. Around the metros, and they wouldn't give the tickets to their parents, so they'd have accumulation of tickets in their pockets, and then there'd be a court case a month later, or 2 months later, with all these tickets, and their parents didn't know. Next thing you know, they're up for juvenile courts, and I couldn't understand why this was going on and why things weren't even said about it in public. So I got involved. So I started a forum at Vendôme Metro, and I started a forum at Villa Maria. And I'm usually like that. I said to myself, well, if no one's going to do it, I can't just keep talking about it. I got to do something about it. So I did. I got a table with all the mayors from the borough and a few academics, and got them talking about it and changing it. And the next thing you know, I was on CBC. Then I got people like Stefan Christoph interviewing me, and a few other politically active folks wanted to know why did I wanted to get involved in it. And to me, it was quite obvious. It's just like, well, these black kids are getting targeted, and there's no reason for them to be targeted. It's really a slap on the wrist, more so than putting them into a juvie center.
It was quite striking.
It was crazy.
At Vanier College, when I worked there, I would do sessions with the football team, for instance, which was 50, 60 kids, you know. And there'd be quite a mix from the black community, from the Arab community, and of course, the white gang, the Quebecois gang. And I'd talk to them about discrimination and the problems. And I'd ask, has anybody got a ticket for loitering at the metro? And literally every black male would stand up and say, yes, I did. And the white kids would look astounded. What? They didn't even know. So it is important.
So what it was is that a lot of these kids were meeting their friends from other schools, but they'd meet them in the metro.
That's convenient.
That's all it was.
It's the job of the metro was to bring people together.
Yeah. But, it's a lot of kids, mind you. You know, we'd say a good pack.
But I don't know that it's changed much either.
It's a lot better.
Is it?
Yeah. before at Von Dohmer's Law, a lot of kids, and it could be intimidating to for the old folks and stuff. But
okay,
but it's changed a bit now.
Okay, yeah. But are the kids still getting hit like that?
Yes, most of the kids from Burgundy are now in jail.
Oh yeah,
yeah, but for other reasons, for crimes and shootings and
oh dear,
yeah, gangs and stuff. Yeah.
What other community involvement have you had? Tyndale?
Yeah, well, I was at Tyndale for the 2 years, and that was cool. I worked for Head and Hands for a bit.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and that was mostly grant writing and taking care of street people.
Mm-hmm.
And being down at St. Jacques Street from 5 in the afternoon till 3 in the morning, fighting young girls who were just getting off the highway and going into the hotels.
Uh-oh.
So finding them shelter right away. A lot of native women,
mm-hmm.
16 to about 20, doing the same thing.
That was part of your Head and Hands?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we found grants for these people and getting, you know, we had the food banks and
get them into housing, get them into schooling.
Get them into schooling, but yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
Excellent. Yeah. Wow, you've been a busy man on many fronts.
Trying.
And what do you do for fun?
Play music.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's fun. That's fun for me. Besides that, I don't play sports anymore. I'm not active in sports anymore. So it's mostly music or actually going out to see a good show.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And I hear you go up north occasionally and go
sometimes
down to the townships occasionally?
But not in the last year or so.
No?
I'd say 3 years ago, I was pretty much in the bush all the time.
What?
I'm no longer in the bush with, and part of it's because I'm not with Guy anymore. Yeah, because we back in the day we used to build Quincy's, which were small igloos, and then we'd make debris huts for the animals.
Guy Quinn was a physical education teacher at Vanier College,
yeah,
and was part of this program called Science of Survival, where instructors like Andy would help the students on a weekend challenge. These were often students.
And it was really good for me to be there because there wasn't a lot of black kids that were doing outdoor stuff.
Nope.
Right?
Well, so, in fact, yeah, it's quite normal. The immigrant community to Canada isn't familiar with the Canadian bush, the Canadian wilderness,
right,
the Canadian lifestyle when it comes out to enjoying the outdoors. In fact, sometimes it's quite intimidating. Wolves and bears,
yeah,
and things are frightening.
And they got to know that kind of thing, too, where they got to see tracking and mm-hmm. the smells and a lot of stuff, or, you know, from making bannock to, you know, a bunch of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
No, that was pretty inspirational, that kind of stuff. Mm. What are we listening to now?
This is a reggae track by a guy named Joe Gibbs. And the name of the track is State of Emergency. And it's the time period of the Jamaican politics fighting over the parties.
Oh, okay.
JLP
okay.
party and the PNP party.
PNP.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen, Andy, I've enjoyed this. We've got about 8 minutes left.
Okay.
And I'm thinking I'm just going to turn the show back over to you. And thank you so much
for
bringing us up to date. I wonder if anybody else has a question before I do that. Sure, please, could you just come and speak to the mic? Or speak to us through the mic?
Hi, Andy.
Hey.
I'm wondering, how do we keep the medium of radio vital? And can you talk about your future visions for CKUT?
The radio vital, you said?
Yeah, the medium of radio in this age of podcasts and all sorts of other things that are kind of taking over.
Yeah, well, I just found out in Montreal there's a rise of record cutting again, which makes me really, really happy. I just found a dude named Zach yesterday who's cutting records. And there's two people in Marlin who are cutting records. So I'm hoping that we'll... And then we have two record shops, as you know, on Bernard Street. And I'm hoping there is going to be, a throwback kind of period where we do have records all over the place again. But it's still a small group of people. MP3s still rule. And... hopefully, we can actually change that by having more DJs play records, but that's not really happening on a large level, a large scale either. So I'm still willing to do it, and I hope DJs like Scott C and a few others will continue that. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I said earlier, this is all part of CQUT's time capsule, celebrating their 30th anniversary of licensed on-air broadcasting. We've spent the last couple hours, Andy and I, going over his role at CQUT and in music at large and in many, many places. This broadcast will be available very shortly after we go off the air. I think in about 20 minutes, you can go to the archives on CQUT and download the whole thing and re-listen to it as you wish.
Actually, it's the day after.
Is it the day after? Anyway, it doesn't take too darn long, and it's archived. I've caught it very quickly. And then it's all going to be converted, not all of it, but a lot of it will become part of podcasts. That will be CQT's podcast list that you can also download and take with you. CQT has a proud record of broadcasting alternative of everything, I keep saying. I say music, news, culture. I'm sure if I went through it, we'd find all sorts of things out there. Family and OWL, the old women live, they're all out there doing it. And CQT makes that possible for us. And that's why I'm so happy community radio lets a grumpy old man like me get on and complain about how the world abuses Africa, for instance. And so I'm always happy to brag about that. And
As we're ending, I was wondering, Andy, if there were any more outdoor gigs you're planning for the summer. I can bring the kids too.
I get calls for Pierre de Courant and a few other places, and I'm not really sure at this point. Most of the gigs I'm going to be doing are with a crew of DJs called Afro Discoteca. So we play Afrobeat and disco and a lot of African rhythms in terms of percussive, very percussive tracks. So I'm doing about three or four gigs with those guys. I'm doing the 20th anniversary for Turntables on the Hudson in New York. They're doing a circuit in North America, so they're coming to Montreal. So I'm one of the DJs who's going to be playing. The label owner is a guy named Nicodemus, so he's going to be coming to Montreal to be doing that. I'm going to be playing at Gypsy Cumbia, some cumbia records coming up. And then the rest of it's going to be Jazz Amnesty, hooking up with Thievery Corporation and a few other places, three other groups. I'm hoping to do something with Jazzanova, but the budget's not there, so we got to figure it out.
I don't know how you keep all track of all this without using a computer or something. You got so many things on the go. Andy, you're an athlete, a musician, a teacher, a student of life, a student of the world. All I can say is thank you very much for giving us such insights. And I don't know how you end your show normally. Maybe you could do that. We've got about 3 minutes left or 4 minutes left.
Well, I just want to thank everyone for being here. I appreciate it. A lot of familiar faces in the crowd, and I'd like to thank CKT, Louise Burns, and Alex Moskos for doing this for me. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Hang on to me while the song keeps running out. Late now, you know my baby. Rockin' roses get on smoke. Girl, if it lasts for an hour, well, it's alright. Keep that on now. Just set the world right. No need to say peace to no man for a happy tune. You just roll along. Child, you've got the way to make me happy. You and me, moving style. Crocklin' Rose, you're a stall-born woman. You make me sing like a guitar. So hang on to me while the song keeps running down.
Where you gonna run? Where you gonna hide? See, nurse, where you gonna run? Where you gonna hide? Remember when you chose stones? You are living in a glass house. Remember when you chose stones? You are living in a glass house. The road is for us all. Don't matter how you may tall. You boasting for a small. You'll never conquer me. Although the road may be rocky, remember that hero's creep. You boasting for a seat. You'll never conquer me. Are living in a glass house.